The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. If you've ever felt like modern political debates about the economy and the environment are just stuck in a zero-sum shouting match, well, you're definitely not alone. Today, we're diving into the history of that very fight, looking at it through Paul Sabin's really essential book, The Bet.
Yeah, this book unpacks one of the maybe the most famous intellectual showdowns of the modern era, that 1980 wager between the biologist Paul Ehrlich and the economist Julian Simon.
Right. It sounds simple, right? A bet about the price of five metals.
Yeah, just five metals. But it became this huge proxy war for two incredibly different visions of humanity's future, you know.
Okay, so let's set the stage. On one side, you've got Paul Ehrlich. He's the classic doomster, isn't he? Preaching about the inescapable limits of our finite planet. It's that biological view.
Exactly. The Malthusian idea, basically. We're running out of room, running out of resources, running out of time. Limits are real, and they're closing in.
And then facing him, Julian Simon, the ultimate boomster.
Totally. He had this almost absolute faith in human ingenuity, in the market's endless ability to innovate its way out of any crisis. For him, resources weren't really the issue.
Like I say.
Because the human mind, people, are the ultimate resource. That was his mantra.
Okay, so our mission for you in this deep dive is really to show how this very public and frankly kind of toxic clash ended up creating this damaging false dichotomy.
Yeah, this either thinking that still paralyzes our ability to forge smart, pragmatic policy today.
Mm-hmm.
And Sabin, as a historian, he helps us cut through that noise and maybe find a more useful third way.
That perspective is key, isn't it? Sabin's background.
It really is. He's a professor of history and American studies at Yale. So crucially, he's not an economist trying to, you know, defend Simon's math.
Nor a biologist defending Ehrlich's dire warnings.
Right. He comes in as the impartial chronicler. He's not really trying to prove who is ultimately right about the future, which is refreshing.
So what's his focus then?
He's meticulously tracking how these polarized ideas evolved. He's asking, how did we get stuck in this ideological straitjacket in the first place?
Got it. He's less interested in the bet's outcome itself and more in why it happened and what its shadow, its legacy means for us now.
Exactly. Especially for people trying to solve things like, you know, climate change or water scarcity today. He wants to understand the consequences of framing complex ecological issues with this simple dramatic wager.
Okay, let's unpack the book's core argument then. The bet is presented as this sweeping intellectual and political history.
That's right. It explains how these two fundamentally different worldviews, one rooted in biological carrying capacity, the other in pure economic ingenuity, how they came to define and ultimately just divide the whole modern environmental debate.
And the history starts quite a way back, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's fascinating. He traces it from post-World War II, a time of just massive technological optimism. You know, we'd conquered so much. The feeling was, why couldn't we conquer nature too?
But then anxiety started creeping in the 60s.
Right. You get Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which really raises the alarm about the hidden costs of industry, the things we weren't seeing.
But the idea that really cemented this narrative of inevitable scarcity, that was Paul Ehrlich's 1968 bombshell, wasn't it? The population bomb.
Oh, absolutely. That book basically established the scarcity perspective in the public mind. The idea that we need limits, we need regulation, probably top-down government control to save us from ourselves.
And it was that idea, that call for control, that really sparked the counter-movement.
Precisely. It fueled this ferocious conservative counter-movement championed by Julian Simon. They needed an intellectual basis to push back.
So Sabin's big insight, the thread through the whole book, is that this entire clash, this Ehrlich versus Simon thing, it's cemented a false choice.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have to choose between saving the environment or growing the economy. He argues we desperately need a third way that acknowledges both truths.
Ehrlich's truth about ecological constraints.
Mm-hmm. And Simon's truth about the potential of human creativity and innovation.
Okay, so let's dig into the first figure, Paul Ehrlich, the prophet of doom. His background is important, right? He was a biologist at Stanford.
Yes, and specifically, he studied butterfly populations. That's really key.
Why butterflies?
Well, because he essentially looked at human beings through the same lens. He saw humanity, like any animal population, inevitably reaching and then overshooting the carrying capacity of its environment.
So that biological perspective shaped everything for him.
It did. It gave him a unique viewpoint. But you could argue it also created a bit of a blind spot when it came to You know, complex human social systems, economics, adaptation. Things butterflies don't really do in the same way.
And that led directly to the population bomb in 68.
Right. A very powerful, very stark Malthusian argument. Unchecked population growth will outstrip resources. It will lead to mass famine, societal collapse.
The language was pretty apocalyptic.
Oh, definitely. Terrifying. And it really forced the environmental movement into the policy arena with this incredibly stark warning act now, or face catastrophe.
Okay, so that sets the stage for the pushback. Enter Julian Simon and the Cornucopian counterattack.
Yes, Simon. He was an economist, a bit of a contrarian. He looked at the historical data, particularly economic data, and just refused to buy the doom and gloom narrative.
What did he see instead?
He saw living standards consistently improving globally, even if the population exploded. That just didn't fit Ehrlich's model in his eyes.
So his book, The Ultimate Resource, from 1981, laid out his counterargument. What was the core thesis?
It was actually quite simple and quite powerful. Human beings are the ultimate resource. That's the title. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Meaning scarcity isn't some fixed physical or ecological limit. For Simon, it's primarily an economic condition. When a resource gets scarce, its price goes up.
And that price signal is key.
Absolutely fundamental for Simon. That rising price is the beautiful market mechanism that incentivizes entrepreneurs to innovate, find substitutes, increase efficiency, find more of the resource.
So more people isn't necessarily a problem.
For Simon, more people meant more brains, more potential innovators to solve problems. It was a completely optimistic take.
And this message found a very receptive audience, politically speaking.
Immediately. You have to remember the context. The emerging conservative movement of the 70s and 80s was ideologically opposed to exactly the kind of top-down government regulation and environmental alarmism that Ehrlich represented.
Simon gave them the intellectual ammunition.
He really did. He provided a framework to argue that environmental problems weren't something to panic about, and they were best solved by free markets and ingenuity, not by burdensome government controls.
Okay, so you have these two intellectual titans, these opposing worldviews. And eventually, it leads to the actual wager.
Yeah, Simon basically got frustrated. He saw Ehrlich's claims as unscientific doom-mongering and, well, he challenged him to put his money where his mouth was.
And Ehrlich took the bait.
He did. In 1980, Ehrlich and two colleagues accepted. They bet $1,000.
On what exactly?
On the combined inflation-adjusted price of five specific metals, chromium, copper, nickel, tin, and tungsten, over 10 years.
So the logic was, if prices go up, scarcity is real, Ehrlich wins.
Right, limits are biting.
If prices go down, ingenuity and markets are working, Simon wins.
Exactly. Scarcity is being overcome by human cleverness. Sabin frames this as a sort of brilliant but also terrible moment.
Why terrible?
Because it created this incredibly simple dramatic narrative, perfect for the media. But it reduced incredibly complex issues down to a simple price trend for five commodities. It became this proxy war for the soul of American environmental and economic policy.
So the moment of truth arrives, October 1990. What happened?
Well, the result was pretty decisive on the face of it. The price of every single one of those five metals had dropped. Simon won.
Every single one.
Yep. He famously received a check from Ehrlich for, it was $576.07. A clear win based on the terms of the bet.
Okay, so wait. If Simon won so decisively, doesn't that kind of prove Ehrlich was wrong? Why are we even still debating this? Why do environmental problems seem, if anything, worse now?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And that's really the core of Sabin's analysis. The victory was actually way more complicated than just markets triumphed.
How so?
Well, for one thing, the price drops were heavily influenced by factors outside simple resource availability, like the global recession in the early 1980s. That absolutely crushed demand for industrial metals.
Okay, so less demand means lower prices, regardless of supply.
Exactly. Plus, there were huge technological efficiency gains happening, and crucially, material substitution. Think about fiber optics starting to replace copper in telecommunications. That slashes demand for copper.
Right. So it wasn't just Simon's ultimate resource finding new mines. It was a mix of economic downturns, smart engineering, and finding alternatives.
Precisely. It was a messy confluence of factors, not a clean, simple ideological win for Simon's worldview, even though he certainly presented it that way.
And that leads to the legacy Sabin talks about, the polarization.
Yes. The legacy was just hardened polarization.
Yeah.
Simon took the win as absolute vindication. Markets solve everything, period. No need for alarm.
And Ehrlich.
Ehrlich, on the other hand, basically dismissed the loss as completely irrelevant. He argued, okay, fine, the price of 5 metals dropped. Who cares? That tells us nothing about the real issues.
Like climate change, biodiversity loss.
Exactly. Deforestation, ocean acidification, the big systemic ecological problems he cared about. He felt the bet was a distraction, a sideshow that proved nothing about planetary health.
So the debate just stopped being about evidence.
Pretty much. It calcified into this rigid battle of worldviews. Both sides used the outcome to double down on their existing beliefs and essentially justify not listening to the other side.
Yeah.
And that's where Sabin argues the rule damage began. It shut down productive conversation.
Okay, let's really focus then on the critical intellectual takeaways Sabin pulls from this whole story, because they feel incredibly relevant now, especially with debates around, say, net zero goals.
They really are crucial. The first big one is simply the peril of that polarization itself. Sabin hammers this home. Reducing complex scientific issues like climate change, like resource management, reducing them to an either doom versus boom choice is just intellectually dishonest.
It sort of forces us into tribal corners, right?
Totally. Mm-hmm. Instead of actually looking for solutions that, you know, might require some compromise, some nuance, maybe borrowing ideas from both sides.
And this connects to maybe the most critical theme Sabin identifies, Simon's big blind spot.
Yes. The fatal flaw in Simon's purely market-centric view, the problem of externalities.
Okay, explain that. This feels really important for listeners to grasp.
It's absolutely essential. Oh. Remember, Simon won the bet because the market price of the metals fell. But market prices, fundamentally, do not capture the external costs of economic activity.
What kind of costs?
Well, think about it. The price of copper doesn't include the cost of the carbon emissions released when you mine and smelt it. It doesn't include the cost of the pollution perhaps dumped into a river nearby or the habitat destroyed to dig the mine.
Those are costs borne by society or the environment, but not by the producer or the buyer directly in the price.
Exactly. Simon's entire framework pretty much ignored the value of things that don't have a convenient price tag attached. Clean air, stable climate, biodiversity. These are the externalities.
So the bet itself was kind of a flawed experiment from the start?
You could definitely argue that. Because metal prices are actually a terrible proxy for the overall health and stability of the planet's ecosystems. We can get really good at making metals cheaper.
While simultaneously wrecking the environment.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Which was, ironically, Ehrlich's underlying point all along.
Wow. Okay. And the third theme Sabin highlights.
It's the co-opting of science by politics, which happens all the time, right? But this story is a classic example.
How so?
Ehrlich's dire warnings, based on his science, became the fuel for environmental activism and calls for government regulation. Makes sense. But then Simon's optimism, based on his economic science, was eagerly seized upon by a political movement that wanted to roll back those very regulations.
So the scientific ideas themselves became political weapons, basically.
Yeah, tools in an ideological war rather than inputs into a rational policy discussion.
It really is amazing how these arguments from the 70s and 80s are still playing out almost verbatim today. Let's maybe crystallize those opposing views as Sabin presents them.
Okay. So you have Ehrlich's neo-Malthusian stance, think. The Earth is a finite spaceship. We're stretching these limits to the breaking point. The core message is ecological finitude, urgency, the need for limits, maybe control. It's a biological view of the world.
Got it. Finite spaceship. Then, on the flip side, Simon's cornucopian view.
Right. Think. The ultimate resource is people. Scarcity isn't some physical absolute. It's an economic condition that unleashes the human mind. The emphasis here is all on innovation, adaptation, progress, driven by market signals and human ingenuity.
Two fundamentally different ways of seeing the problem.
And potentially the solution. But Sabin's core argument, the synthesis that he argues really matters most for us now, is basically this. He says, look, this polarized debate was ultimately a distraction.
A distraction from what?
From the real challenge.
Yeah.
Which is, how do we harness the undeniable innovative power of Market Simon's engine to solve the very real ecological problems, Ehrlich's reality, that market prices themselves often fail to address.
Okay, that's the call for the both-hand approach, not either.
Exactly. We need to integrate Ehrlich's ecological truths, the reality of planetary boundaries, into Simon's powerful market mechanisms. Make the market acknowledge the limits.
Okay, so practically speaking, what does this mean for us today? How can we apply this third way thinking that Sabin advocates?
Well, first off, just develop some critical media literacy around these issues. When you see that simple black and white debate on TV, you know, the climate scientist versus the think tank economist, ask yourself questions.
Like what?
Like, what are their underlying assumptions? What are their disciplinary blind spots, like we talked about with Ehrlich and Simon? Are they measuring success purely by economic price, or are they considering actual ecological value? Be skeptical of those easy narratives.
Good point. Don't just accept the framing. Okay, what else?
Second, apply this thinking to pragmatic problem solving, yeah. Whether it's in your community, your job, whatever. It's about moving beyond just arguing for or against markets.
And instead asking.
Instead asking, how can we make markets work for the planet? Look for solutions that cleverly blend economic mechanisms with environmental goals.
Can you give an example?
The classic example, and one Sabin implicitly points towards, is something like a well-designed carbon tax or robust cap and trade system.
How does that fit the third way?
Because it does exactly what we were just talking about. It takes that invisible external cost of pollution, Ehrlich's ecological reality, and it makes it visible and tangible through Simon's favorite tool, the price signal.
It puts a price on carbon emissions.
Right. It forces the market mechanism to internalize that external cost.
Right.
It says, okay, market, you're great at innovating. Now innovate ways to avoid this cost we've just created.
So instead of just arguing about whether climate change is real or whose fault it is,
you deploy a market-based tool that actually rewards the innovation Simon loved, but specifically directs it toward achieving the environmental outcomes Ehrlich demanded. You make the problem expensive, so ingenuity works to solve it.
That makes a lot of sense, using the engine for a different purpose.
And finally, maybe a more personal application. Yeah. Really try to understand that crucial difference between price and value. Simon won the bet based on price, but Sabin's book compels us to actively value the things that often don't have a price tag.
Clean air, clean water, biodiversity, a stable climate.
Exactly. Recognizing their intrinsic value, even if the market doesn't price them properly yet. And letting that deeper sense of value inform our choices as consumers, as investors, as citizens.
So wrapping up, the biggest lesson from the bet seems to be this urgent need to shift our thinking. Moving away from that destructive either choice environment or economy.
Yeah, moving towards a both-hand framework. One that fully acknowledges the real planetary boundaries we face, but also actively leverages human innovation and smart economics to help us operate successfully within those boundaries.
It's about integration, not opposition. What was the most valuable takeaway for you personally from Sabin's analysis?
For me, honestly, it was the lesson in humility. You had these two brilliant, incredibly influential men, Ehrlich and Simon, both utterly certain about their predictions for the future.
And yet
both were wrong in critical ways. Ehrlich underestimated adaptation and ingenuity. Simon completely missed the significance of externalities and ecological degradation that prices don't capture.
So the takeaway is,
Sabin really teaches us to be incredibly wary of any simple deterministic predictions about hugely complex systems, whether they're human systems or natural systems. Certainty can be dangerous. We need adaptive approaches, synthetic thinking, not rigid ideological certainty.
That feels like a really profound and necessary lesson, especially now, trying to navigate the sheer messiness and complexity of the 21st century. Thank you for diving deep with us on this one.
My pleasure. It's a crucial story.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.